You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Thursday, May 5th, 2011. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Great program for you today, ladies and gentlemen. Daniel Levy, Senior Research Fellow, Co-Director of Mideast Task Force at the New America Foundation, will be here to discuss the outlines, the deal between Fatah and Hamas to create a unified government. And, this just in. Hey, remember me? Still kicking around. Not going to show up at ground zero today. I had one demand. It wasn't a big one. Just wanted a gold-plated bullhorn to be handed to me by that Obama. But I can get one. Forget it. I'm not going to go there. Didn't renew my passport. I go to New York. So George Bush will not be joining President Obama at Ground Zero in New York City today, I guess to mark the killing of Osama bin Laden. Sort of heinous in my estimation, but perhaps bringing some closure to those who lost people at Ground Zero on September 11th. His spokesman said he appreciated the invite, speaking of George Bush, but has chosen in his post-presidency to remain largely out of the spotlight.
I don't think so.
I mean, except for the time where he's trying to sell a book. And, of course, in 6 months from now, when he heads, less than 6 months, when he heads to 9/11, I am sure, for the 10th anniversary, celebrate the day that I spoke in a bullhorn and said, Osama bin Laden, I hope you can hear me now. We're coming to get you. I was speaking allegorically speaking.
Maybe he planned that Obama would catch Osama bin Laden.
That's right. This was all part of George Bush's plan. But apparently it's not just that he's camera shy, ladies and gentlemen. The New York Daily News reports, and this is from Thomas DeFrank, who is a long time known, sort of have access to the Bushies. He declined because Obama hurt his fee-fee. He hurt his fee-fee. George W. Bush won't be at Ground Zero with President Obama on Thursday, in part because he feels his team is getting short shrift in the decade-long manhunt for Osama bin Laden. Quote, Bush viewed this as an Obama victory lap, a highly placed source told the Daily News Wednesday. Well, if George Bush is upset that he's not getting enough credit, well, why did he turn down the invitation to join in that credit at Ground Zero? But Obama's claiming all the credit, and a lot of other people deserve it, the source added. My fee-fees. Obama gave no credit whatsoever to the intelligence infrastructure the Bush administration set up that is being hailed from the left and right as setting in motion the operation that got bin Laden. It rubbed Bush the wrong way. Well, frankly, we know that the torture regime that George Bush put in place The only information we got was the fake name of this courier. We also know that George Bush, sometime in 2005, right around the time that they were building this compound for Osama bin Laden in Pakistan, shut down the CIA unit that for 10 years up to that point, started by Bill Clinton, was looking for Osama bin Laden. And in fact, I also believe he said something to the effect of, I'm not that concerned about him anymore. I don't think about him. Or perhaps he was just throwing us all off the scent. I'm not going to go down there unless I want a golden bullhorn. I want a golden bullhorn, and I want it maybe also with like a pretzel on the side. George, where are you? Oh, I'm in my study. I'm in my study with my golden bullhorn. Not, maybe just about to choke on a pretzel, as it were. So that'll be it, folks. We won't see George Bush until he comes out and preens in September. Let's celebrate the real anniversary. The day I spoke in a bullhorn. I guarantee you someone's going to give him a bullhorn on that day. I will bet my life on it. If he hasn't already received one, he will get one on that day. All right, folks, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Daniel Levy on this Hamas-Fatah deal. We'll be right back. We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome back to the show Daniel Levy, Senior Research Fellow, Co-Director of Mideast Task Force at the New America Foundation. Thank you for joining us, Daniel.
The pleasure's mine, Sam. Lovely to be talking to you on the airwaves again.
Yes. Now let's. I want to touch base with you on this Fatah-Hamas deal that was at least announced. I don't know if it's fully edified yet, but it was announced this past week. Tell us what the broad outlines of this deal are.
Well, as you just said, there's perhaps as much unknown, I don't want to start sounding like a former Secretary of Defense, as there is known about this deal. Basically, a document has been worked on for many years. It was initially presented in 2009. They have now signed that document with an additional set of addended articles to the document. I don't want to bore people with all the details, but what it is it is a set of agreements over holding new elections, both for this limited self-governing entity called the Palestinian Authority, the Palestinian Parliament inside the territories, and elections for the broader Palestinian National Movement, the PLO, number one. Number two, it's how are things managed until there are elections. There's a division, as people know, between the West Bank and Gaza. So there are arrangements for who runs security forces, release of people from each other's faction being held respectively in the West Bank and in Gaza. There are arrangements for a technical government, a technocratic government that will run the Palestinian Authority in the meantime. All of these things have been agreed at the kind of 30,000 foot level. What we don't have yet, and it could unravel as this begins to be thrashed out, is the details. There's an agreement in principle. It's time to end the division, time to reunify, create a Palestinian national movement, create the linkage again politically between the West Bank and Gaza. But really, I would say all the details have yet to be agreed. And what you can probably expect to see on the ground, the reality on the ground, is not much change. But politically, it's very significant.
And tell me the significance of the caretaker Egyptian government essentially closing this deal, at least at this level.
Well, I think you put your finger on, I think, what the headline item is here. I think the headline is less to do with how this immediately impacts the minutiae of Palestinian internal management, and it's much more about what does this tell us about one of the first major regional diplomatic acts of post-Mubarak Egypt. Because I think many people look at this and they say, although under Mubarak, the Egyptians were working this file, they were convening talks between the Palestinians. In reality, they were talks for talk's sake, and there was no real intention to seal a deal on the part of Mubarak. In comes this new caretaker government, and not only did they cease to be an obstacle, they became a positive force for getting the deal done. And I think what it tells us is that we now have the beginnings of an Egypt that has returned to the regional diplomatic playing field as a country that has to be a bit responsive to its public opinion. The Egyptian public wanted this to happen. They didn't like Mubarak's previous policy. And as a player that acts somewhat independently. It looks at its interests, it looks at its positions on things, and acts according to those, rather than, I would argue, taking its cue from Washington or from Jerusalem.
Interesting.
And I actually think it's not been a good thing to have an Egypt as, if I can put it like this, essentially the sick man of Arabia, which just didn't have any diplomatic regional weight. Egypt's an important country, a main country, but it was a country that wasn't there. And that meant that Middle East regional politics had no hefty Arab actor. You had Israel as an important actor. You had Turkey, another non-Arab country, as an important actor. You had Iran, another non-Arab country, as an important actor. But in the regional diplomatic arena, there was no Arab state that was playing a lead role. It looks like Egypt will return to its more natural position as a diplomatic leader in the region.
Daniel, let me ask you this. I mean, if it's the case that there was no movement on these talks because in some respects Egypt was under Mubarak, was functioning, maybe this is overstating the case, but you're alluding to it on some level, as essentially a U.S.-Israel proxy. What does it say about Israel and U.S. interests, and maybe they're not necessarily so aligned in this context? I mean, if does that make any sense? I guess it's a question.
Oh, it does, Sam. The question makes sense for sure. I think what it tells us is this, is that there's been a factor that we have been able, although I would say at a cost, to pretend doesn't exist. And that factor is Arab public opinion. So demands could be made of autocratic, non-democratic Arab leaders to get on board with policies which had no domestic legitimacy. By saying that, I'm not suggesting that the revolutionary change that we've seen in Egypt or elsewhere was mainly because of foreign policy. It wasn't. It was mainly domestic grievance driven. But the dignity deficit that was largely domestic also had a foreign policy component to it. The public felt that Egypt's foreign policy, for instance, was undignified. Now, that doesn't mean that the demand from below, to which the new regime will be responsive, is to cut all ties with the U.S., is to take up a similar position to Iran, or to end the peace treaty with Israel. It does mean to have a more, in their eyes, balanced policy. You know what? Look at Turkey. Turkey's still in NATO. Turkey is a key ally of the United States. Turkey is trying to be constructive on a number of issues. Turkey still has relations with Israel. Turkey has more tricky, more uncomfortable relations with Israel, I would argue, mostly because this Palestinian issue is still unresolved. And I would expect, in many ways, that Egypt will come out in a similar place. The challenge, therefore, because as you say, that is, Israeli and American interests are not coterminous. They're not exactly the same thing in this respect. And the challenge for the U.S. is going to be, how does it position itself against this new regional reality? How does it get itself on the right side of Palestinian freedom when everyone else in the region is now calling for freedom and democracy? The challenge for Israel, I would argue, is how does it, with eyes wide open, look at the challenges of its new regional strategic environment, and if there is an Israeli plan for a rainy day, which says, you know what, we've got to get out of the business of occupying the Palestinians. We've got to take this grievance off of the regional agenda. If that plan for a rainy day exists in someone's drawer, this is the time to get it out, because otherwise the strains that will be created for Israel in the region and for the difference between what an American interest is and what an Israeli position is, those strains are going to become very difficult. And even if the way politics plays out in America means that America's position won't change very much, it is not going to be good news for either Israel or America. The problem for America isn't that it has a close relationship with Israel, per se. The problem is it has a close relationship and is seen to facilitate an Israel that can't get out of the business of denying the Palestinians their freedom. That's the key variable.
Now, if the Israelis don't start to move and take this opportunity and see this as a new reality, what happens when the idea of Palestinian international recognition of statehood shows up at the UN sometime this year?
Well, you know, in many ways, I think that that's going to be one of the easier issues to deal with. It's going to get a lot of attention. It's going to be depicted as a big oy vey moment by some of Israel's friends and by Israel itself. But I think that if everything is stuck, as it has been for an awfully long time, and if the Palestinians go to the United Nations and say, look, recognize us as a state. We've been doing state building. Everyone recognizes we've got there. Everyone knows this is stuck. You all think that the 67 territories are occupied. Then I think they will get a majority at the United Nations. There are those in Israel. They're a minority, but they have spoken out and said it's in Israel's interest to have this happen, because it's in Israel's interest to have the idea of two states based on 67 entrenched at the United Nations. The problem is that the current Israeli government, and I have to be fair, that the government reflects the current Israeli zeitgeist, that current government doesn't see things that way. It's digging in, and that what might flow as a consequence of UN recognition, if Israel doesn't take a more realistic stance, what might flow from that over the coming months after September could ultimately lead to punitive measures against Israel. You know, as someone who was born in the UK but moved to Israel, became Israeli, worked in the system, out the system, it really worries me whether Israel can kind of get on board with where the flow of history is going and not set itself against that, I hope that they make the right call. It's not where the majority opinion is today.
Right, sadly. Well, I agree with you. And Daniel, I really appreciate your taking the time to give us the outlines of and the implications of this deal, and hope to talk to you again soon.
I hope so, and it's great to talk to you, Sam.
We've got to take a break, folks. That was Daniel Levy. He's the Senior Research Fellow, Co-Director of the Mideast Task Force at the New America Foundation. We're going to take a break. We will be back in just a second. Got a lot more news, ladies and gentlemen. Eric Cantor. For the Ryan Medicare plan, before he was against it, before he was for it. I think that's where it is. This guy is zigzagging so much. But I can tell you where the American people are in terms of this Ryan Medicare. Apparently, this is going to be strange, folks. We'll talk about it. We'll break it down when we get back. But people don't want to die broke. Who knew? We'll be right back. Come on and let me know. Should I stay or should I go? Should I stay or should I go now? Should I stay or should I go now? If I go, there will be trouble. All right, folks. So apparently, I know that people are just absolutely shocked to hear this. But people like Medicare. I mean, it's stunning, apparently. But people like Medicare. They don't want the Republicans to destroy it. Now, it obviously comes as a shock to Republicans. They've once again overreached. But the real question, of course, has always been, how much will their corporatist handmaidens in the Democratic Party do their work for them? But senior Republicans on Wednesday conceded that a deal is unlikely on a contentious plan to overhaul Medicare. This is Lori Montgomery in the Washington Post. I don't think overhaul is the right word. Destroy Medicare is really the right word. I mean, I can give you a spatula and say, this is a cup. But I got news for you. You're not going to want to hold liquid in it. So they can call it Medicare if they make it a voucher program where they give seniors about one-third of what the average cost of medical insurance will be, certainly by the time that this plan goes into effect. But it's not Medicare. Medicare provides you with legitimate health insurance. So on the eve, and this is funny because this story was from last night at 9:20 p.m., Majority Leader Eric Cantor said Republicans remain convinced that reining in federal retirement program is the key to stabilize the nation's finance over the long term. But he said Republicans recognize they may need to look elsewhere to achieve consensus. After President Obama excoriated us for a proposal to privatize Medicare. What? If that's all it took, folks, then Obama better get on the ball. He excoriated us. I am willing to bet you. I would say $1 million, but I don't have $1 million. I'm willing to bet you a crappy old Vio laptop that whirs when we turn it on And the hard drive is so loud that we actually have to encase it in some type of foam so that we can do this show. I'm willing to bet you that. Frank Luntz has poll tested the word excoriated. Now, how do I know this? Because when I see a word that Eric Cantor uses and a word that Sean Hannity uses over and over and over again, I mean, Sean Hannity uses that word excoriated like a, you know, like some sophomore at college who just found out that pot exists and read, you know, his first Camus book or something. Just Camus this, Camus that, man, the stranger. The way they use this word excoriated. And there's no doubt in my mind that Frank Luntz or some other right-winger sent out the use the word excoriated. People don't know what it means, but they really don't like it. They don't think anybody should be excoriated. I can only imagine. My guess is that when people hear excoriated, they feel like something like a colonoscopy. There's some like. So Cantor says this last night, and then by this morning he's like, no, we're going to still try and push the destruction of Medicare. So if you're confused about all this debt and budget talk, understand that there's literally a half a dozen budget proposals out there now. And parts or at different stages of being developed. Ken Conrad has one that supposedly Democrats are pissed about. Because it's too far to the right, supposedly, I say, because who knows? Maybe that's exactly what they want their opening bid to be. The Gang of Six is trying to come up with a proposal, but they supposedly can't come up with one. You have the Ryan budget. You have the Republican Steering Committee or something. You have the Progressive Caucus has a budget. And people are trying to work out what elements of this are the Republicans going to put on the table as a ransom to pass the debt, and which one does the Obama administration want them to? Great piece in, I think it was Slate, that shows that thing about Ryan Care, thing about his whole voucher system, it's a mandate. It's a mandate. If you don't use, you don't buy health insurance with the money that we give you, private health insurance, you will suffer a tax penalty.
Survive.
So the part about, you know, it's stealing our freedoms. All our freedom juices are being drained from our body because of the mandate. Because you'd suffer a tax penalty if you don't buy insurance. Ryan has that, except for he imposes it on all old people. All old people. So you better take your Social Security money and part of the money that, you know, use the money we're giving you plus all the Social Security money you're going to have to buy that private insurance or we're going to give you a tax penalty. One more note about the Affordable Care Act. Apparently, 280,000 people under the age of 26 have joined their parents' health plan. The Health and Human Services Department estimated that about 1.2 million young adults would sign up for coverage in 2011. And based on the numbers that have already taken place, they think the number could actually go higher. You guys are on your parents' health plans, yes?
Yeah, until I'm 26.
Yes, both these guys.
No, mine just ended.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Uh-oh.
Yeah.
What are you? Oh, are you 26 now?
Hey, yeah. What happened?
Oh, there you go. When was your birthday?
It's April 7th.
Did we mention it?
I don't know.
Kept it on the down low.
Yeah, you know.
All right, good. We didn't have to buy you a cake. See, money on a. I hope you help yourself to a copy of FUBAR for your birthday. Meanwhile, insurers' profits have gone up. First quarter earnings are up better than expected profits for insurers. But Carl McDonald, analyst at Citigroup, said that higher profits weren't related to the new young adult enrollees because it's not very – there's probably a little bump. It's not that expensive, I guess, to add a 22-year-old to your plan. They don't get sick. McDonald attributed most of the insurers' profit increases this year to their customers using fewer health services, especially hospital care, which just gives you a sense of the incentive structure of insurers. The less you require health care, the more money we make. So if we can discourage you from getting health care, all the better. If we can encourage more younger people, less sick people, and get rid of all our old sick people, like the kind that Paul Ryan would expect would buy health insurance after they're 65, we make more money. Meanwhile, across the country this week, you wouldn't know it, and this is the reason why the Republicans are backing off this. Quinnipiac poll numbers show people like their Medicare. They don't want a voucher system. 89 people arrested this past week protesting Paul Ryan's Medicaid cuts and Medicare. In the nation, Allison Kilkenny of Citizens Radio, Capitol Police arrested 89 disability rights activists on Monday following the group's occupation of the Cannon House Office Building Rotunda. That was incredible video footage. You see that on the news?
I did not.
No, of course you didn't. Because it wasn't on the news. The disability rights group ADAP staged the event to protest Paul Ryan's Medicaid cuts. Nursing home residents in Illinois also turned out to protest proposed Medicaid cuts. Because you know what happens? You're on Medicare. You go into a nursing home. Your Medicare gets drained. Your finances get drained. You are now poor enough to be eligible for Medicaid. So much of Medicaid, contrary to what Rush Limbaugh would tell you, does not go to welfare queens in Cadillacs. It goes to old people. Governor Pat Quinn's budget reduces Lee Manors, this is the nursing home, funding by $500,000. It's going to cut staff and services at the nursing center. It includes cutting Medicaid by 6% or $70 million in state funds, which would result in a federal match of additional $70 million also being wiped out. New Jersey firefighters took to the streets Monday to protest budget cuts and a recent reduction in official fire department staff size. Thousands of people are expecting a rally in downtown Raleigh the other day to protest proposed cuts in the House budget proposal. Thousands are expected to descend upon Pennsylvania State Capitol on the 3rd yesterday to protest Governor Tom Corbett's budget proposal. People are getting out there and protesting, folks. And may not work for war, but I think it does work on these domestic issues. Because you're protesting a more localized legislator. And they seem to pay attention. Unfortunately, yesterday, H.R. 3 passed. What was the party vote on that, Matt? Will you look that up for me? H.R. 3, we talked about this some time ago. This is when the House Republicans, one of the aspects of this H.R. 3 bill.
I've got passing 251 to 175.
Yeah.
That's pretty darn close, I think, to a party line vote. Is that right?
That I have to do some more research, but it sounds like it.
H.R. 3, one of the elements of this, you'll remember, was when Republicans were trying to redefine rape as only forcible rape. So things like statutory rape, incest, that's not really rape for the Republicans. So they took that language out. And they wanted to redefine rape so that if you were, let's say, you're a 12-year-old girl and you're, you're not raped. You're not raped when that 25-year-old uncle has sex with you. I guess that's more like I don't know, family time. So you're not raped, and therefore you're not eligible for Medicaid to pay for your abortion. Unless he roughs you up a little bit. And then, of course, you've got to prove that to the IRS. And so the Republicans who, I guess, I don't know. I mean, is it mean to women to say, like, if you're, we don't see any force, you're not raped? I don't know. I guess you could probably argue that's somewhat misogynist. To get this misogynist aspect of their bill in there, they took the language out, but what they did is they backdoored this by using the use of a committee report, a document that congressional committees produce outlining what they intend a piece of legislation to do. This is from a Nick Bauman piece in Mother Jones. If there's ever a court fight about the interpretation of the law, judges will look at the committee report as evidence of congressional intent and use it to decide what the law actually means. H.R. 3 says the bill will not allow the federal government to subsidize abortions in cases of statutory rape. The bill itself doesn't say anything like that, but the committee report says that. If a court decides that legislators intended to exclude statutory rape-related abortions eligibility for Medicaid funding, then that will be the effect. Now, you will hear conservatives say, well, this is just the Hyde Law. Or the Hyde Amendment, I should say. The Hyde Amendment was first passed in 1976. It forbids the use of federal funding to pay for abortions via Medicaid or other health services. Originally, Hyde allowed such funding only to save the life of a pregnant woman, but in 1993, abortion rights supporters were able to add two additional exceptions that allow Medicaid to fund abortions in cases of rape or incest. Those rape and incest exceptions have stood ever since. So this actually is a Hyde Amendment plus. Rape involving, you know, statutory rape and not beat up rape or incest. Sorry. You must have that child. If you don't have the money for an abortion, you are forced to carry that child. I don't know if you're forced to raise it. Maybe that's the next step. Maybe the Republicans in Congress should add a provision. If you are statutorily raped, if you are the victim of incest, not only must you be forced to carry that child to give birth to that child, you must be forced to keep it, and you should be forced to name it after your rapist. How's that? How about this? How about you get a tax penalty if you do not name that child after the rapist? That's what the Republicans should do. This should be the next Republican proposal. Forced pregnancy, forced childbirth, forced to name the child after the rapist. Sounds like a perfect Republican plan to me. No? H.R. 3 goes further than this. Not only, as I've just mentioned, that H.R. 3 narrows the definition of rape, forces poor women who can't afford an abortion to carry that baby to term and this product of rape, or it also forces you to go to the IRS and prove that you were forcibly raped. But it also screws with insurance coverage writ large. It will raise rates. It will force tax penalties on small businesses who carry health insurance that covers abortion for its employees. Right? It's your money, right? Isn't that what the Republicans say? It's your money. It's your tax dollars. They are using the tax code to punish private businesses that carry private health insurance that happens to cover abortion services for female employees. Why stop there? Why not punish through our tax code anybody who offers health insurance to their employees that covers birth control? Or what about condoms? I don't think maybe some condoms are covered. I don't know. Or erection medicine, right? What is it called? What is it?
Viagra.
Viagra. Well, Viagra is covered under some plans, right? If the doctor says you need it. The Republican hypocrisy on this is stunning, but it also, it's not even hypocrisy. This is the Republican ideology. The stuff about taxes being your money and this and that. No, that's a lie. That's simply a lie. It's your money when it goes to rich people. It's not your money when it covers, when it can be used as a cudgel to force their culture war on you. That's the bottom line. And anybody who believes different is either willfully ignorant or moronic or just plain ignorant. So there, you have three choices. All right, folks, we're out of time. I got more stories, but let me do this one story. We will close on this one. I mentioned last week that Chris Christie, Ritz-Carlton Christie, as I like to call him, and please, I would love Chris Christie to run for president. I would love Chris Christie. My two favorite days in the presidential aspirations of Chris Christie will be the day that he announces and the day after the New Hampshire primary when he drops out of the race. Those will be my two favorite days. I don't think he'll run. Not this time. Who knows in the future? But Chris Christie, the man who shut down the building of a tunnel under the Hudson, which would have created thousands of jobs, which would have raised property values in New Jersey, which would have limited congestion, which would have brought, it would brought an extra train too, right? Is that right?
Yep.
I mean, stunning. Stunning. Is now committed hundreds of millions of dollars. Talk about good money after bad. The state has already wasted $1 billion on Xanadu. I don't know what they're calling it now. Freedomville.
The American dream.
The American dream. The American pipe dream. They're planning now. Chris Christie has told his government, the state government, that, you know, despite the fact that we're cutting stuff for teachers, we can afford to spend several hundred million dollars on this project. The planned opening in 2013 could have political implications for Mr. Christie, who expects to run for re-election in November of that year. Ha. Ha. He'll be on the road. He'll be on the road already in Iowa, probably around 2013. Right? Just attending some events. The state has already spent, by some accounts, as much as $1 billion on financing, tax breaks, and highway improvements to support the development. State will provide $200 million in financing to 555. I don't know if that includes the breaks on sales taxes. And before any of you stupid right-wingers email me about this, if you think all those sales taxes are just going to be made out of whole cloth, they're not going to come at the expense of other sales in the state, you're a moron. And this is how guaranteed this project is to fail. Paul Gersmanian, the firm's senior vice president that is redeveloping America Freedomville or whatever the heck it is.
The American dream.
Oh, yes, the American pipe dream, formerly Xanadu, had this to say about why he thinks it's going to succeed. People always notice how you see the Manhattan skyline from here, he said. What they don't think about is that means Manhattan can see us. Millions of people are going to look out their windows and say, hey, what's that? And then millions of other people are going to turn to that first person and say, that's the reason why we don't live in New Jersey.
Oh, classic New Jersey logic.
Stunning. These people actually think that, like, you're going to get flocks of people from Manhattan to New Jersey. How are they going to get there? Not by train! Not by train anymore! Unbelievable. Unbelievable. You can IM me at Majority FM. Call me, 646-257-3970, 646-257-3920. I think yesterday on the show I said that Morgan Spurlock will be here tomorrow. He won't. He'll be here next week. Tomorrow will be Cliff Schechter. And... folks, you can find that link to my MS walk. Tomorrow will be the last day I think I'll be able to take donations, I think. On majority.fm, if you can become a member, your support is much needed, much appreciated. Please support this show by buying your crap through our Amazon link, which is found at the front page of the Majority Report at majority.fm. You can click through it, bookmark it, use that as your visit to Amazon. You will notice absolutely no difference except for a little sprig in my step, a little sparkle in my eye, a little more optimism when I speak as you transfer the wealth from that behemoth to mehemoth. And don't forget to visit justcoffee.coop. Get all your coffee, tea, and chocolate needs and desires fulfilled. Get a 10% discount by using the coupon code Majority. Majority FM is the I am. I will see you on the flip side.